The Drum Candy Podcast is brought to you by Drum Factory Direct.
Welcome into episode 11 of season 5 of the Drum Candy Podcast. This is your host, Mike Dawson, coming to you from Drum Factory Direct in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This week we have a guest host, Thomas Wendt, is back, and he is interviewing the great Philadelphia-based jazz drummer, Byron Landom. Byron has been a staple on the modern jazz scene since the 1990s, and some of his credits include the late, great Betty Carter, George Coleman, Bobby Hutcherson, Joey DeFrancesco, Frank West, Pat Martino, Cyrus Chestnut, Russell Malone, and many, many more. He also has his own band, and he is on faculty at Temple University. So I'm going to just hand it over to Thomas. So enjoy this chat with Thomas Wendt and Byron Landom.
All right. We'd like to welcome everybody to another edition of the Drum Candy Podcast. Such a pleasure to be here hosting again, guest hosting, and very, very honored to be talking with one of the great modern masters of our time. This is take two. We're very welcome, very, very honored to be welcoming the great Byron Landom. Master Landom, thank you for being with us today again, man. We appreciate it.
Brother, always my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you, man. So, you know, I've been looking forward to this because you are one of the great sons of Philadelphia, and I'm over on the other side of the state in Pittsburgh. And both of our cities, I always say both Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and Detroit are really, really essential cities for jazz music because so many people came out of all these cities. And you came up in Philadelphia's great jazz legacy, man. So why don't we kind of start there? How did you come to the drums, and then how did you come to jazz music?
Well, you know, I have an older brother who's a saxophonist. His name's Robert Landom. And actually, he's a classical clarinetist as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's about 6 years older than me. And his thing getting into the saxophone and playing music, like, he was actually turned on by a friend of my father's. His name is Paul Finney. Turned my brother on to all these, like, Brown and Max Roach records. And Art Blakey records, Maynard Ferguson, was like all these different kinds of like ensemble, like sextet or more bands. Mm-hmm. And my brother, you know, when I started playing, I was kind of interested in R&B. I guess I was about 7 years old. And I kept, you know, I came up with what I was, you know, during my time, Stevie Wonder, you know, Gladys Knight and all that. So I think that those records changed me and my brother's life. From then on, I think I was maybe about 8 or 9 years old, and we got these records, and it was like Max Roach and Clifford Brown, and that was, you know, we heard that, and it was, I kind of like shifted my gear to right away trying to learn how to play swing and play, you know, with these ensembles, and I dug it because it was like, you know, the freedom that it had. I mean, it was discipline, but it was a little more freedom to showcase, you know, the instrumentalists, you know.
Mm. Interesting. Wow,
that's start though. Totally.
Yeah, yeah. So when after you sort of discovered jazz music by way of R&B and whatnot, what were some of your earliest experiences as far as playing the music? How did you sort of come to play the music at first?
Well, you know, for a long time, I was basically home because I was so young, and it's like in this city. And from my brother and from musicians that I had known, like maybe older than me, because I attended all these music camps, it was always a high standard. So I was very afraid at a young age, like going, I wanted to make sure before I sat in with anybody that I could really play the music and understand it to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. So I think that once I got to be about 14, I remember doing like playing with some of the older musicians in town. And I think Joey DeFrancesco was on it. He's younger than me, but we were both doing a recording on the main jazz station here in Philadelphia. But that was some older musicians. And it was like, from then, I think I was 14 and he was 13 or 12 or whatever. And that kind of gave me a lift in terms of knowing, oh, I can do this. And I want to do this because it was so intriguing to me as just something I could never get away from once I started doing it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So was that WRTI then, back then?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's one of the great jazz stations. So could you talk a little bit about what the Philadelphia scene was like for you back then when you started playing? What were some of your early experiences in Philadelphia that sort of were important in your development, maybe?
That's a good question. You know, actually, I think I started to become a fixture on the scene at a young age. I think I was about 16, actually. Mm-hmm. My brother and I had a band at that time, and it was basically under his name, and it had we featured Christian McBride and Eduardo Simon. And I remember us playing a gig at a place in Philly called the Painted Bride. And I did that gig, and a couple of drummers that were well-known drummers, especially in Philly, Greg McDonald and Webb Thomas.
Oh, yeah.
They were both... I know Greg McDonald was working with a great saxophonist named Bootsy Barnes. And Webb Thomas was working with a bassist named Charles Fambro. So after that gig, I got to meet Greg McDonald, and he was really talking to a bunch of people around the city trying to just hook me up with work. And it happened like that way that I met Bootsy Barnes and was working with Bootsy when I was 16. Mm. And I started working with a guitarist named Monette Selma, too. Great guitarist. He passed away maybe about a year ago. And it was the same vibe. It was just through spread of, you know, the word, this young guy is around. He's playing drums really decent, and he knows some of the music. And once I worked with Bootsy, it was like, okay, you know, because I was 16, I was really green. I mean, I had good facility and I had a good understanding of the music, but, you know, I get there with him and he's, you know, I had my sticks in my back pocket, that kind of thing. Where's your mallets? This is a bolero. Where's your mallet? Mallets? What's mallet? You know, that kind of thing. That was a growing experience. And also working with Monette and Charles. Charles was hardcore. You know, it was either sink or swim. You know, you have to really play, and you needed to know some basic tunes and be able to feel your way through a song form if somebody was doing something strange with the harmony or the rhythm, you know. And that kept spreading around, and by the time I was 17, I got a call from this guy named Pete Souders. It was the owner of a place called Ortlieb's Jazz House in Philadelphia, which is a club I've been associated with for many, many years. And I know that most of the jazz musicians who were real prominent during that time, and even 20 years before that, like Shirley Scott and Trudy Pitts, Mickey Roker, Arthur Harper, all these people. And he actually said to me, man, I'd like you to come down and play. And I came down and I sat in and I played. And he hired me and a great bassist by the name of Mike Boone and a great pianist by the name of Sid Simmons to become like a house rhythm section on Tuesdays. Mm. And that was really unique for me because you had all kinds of people any given night. You know, George Benson might come or Terrence Blanchard. And we had some great artists here, like Evelyn Sims, you know. And then I started playing it. Sometimes I was even working with Shirley Scott and Arthur Harper, which was frightening for me because, you know, they had a way of playing. It was just overwhelming for me in a sense. And Shirley would be was one to tell, if things weren't right, she'd say, don't play, just listen, you know. And I'm 17. Those were great. She said, and once I started to listen, I began to understand some concepts about how people approach their music and that you have to be flexible to work with anybody, you know. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. That's been the biggest learning experience for me, is just being able to be in Philadelphia, you know, being able to be around all these great musicians and really, like, they suggest things to you. Like, that was most of my learning. It was word of mouth. It was a grassroots kind of thing. I'm sure you too, you know?
Absolutely.
And so there was that and just intense study and always willing to learn and listen. It's best if you keep your ears open and your mouth shut sometimes.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of the most important things you could say. And it's something that's missing today because there's all this, and I'm not knocking the technology. I mean, we're using it right now. It's wonderful, but there's something about someone giving you a small piece of information and then you having to figure out the rest. There's something in that that I think is really important. Would you agree?
Absolutely. That's what it's about. Nothing's supposed to be like when you put together a puzzle. Nothing's easy. It's going to take time. You've got to find a piece over here and that goes with this piece there. It takes time. And the grassroots thing is special because, you know, we're used to social media and things like that, texting and, you know, living behind a word that we see. Mm-hmm. But when you're sitting in front of, a Mickey Roker or a Bobby Dorham or Billy James or Edgar Bateman or Butch Ballard or and these people looking you in the eye and telling you, say, maybe do this or maybe not do that or maybe think about this. You know, that's what's important. And them telling you how they dealt with adversity and during their careers and stuff like that, that's important. That's what's really going to make you, you know.
Yeah, that's it, man. And it's such a man. I mean, for myself, you know, to get into this music and just happen to be from Pittsburgh, it was like, that's like striking gold. You know, same in Philadelphia. You're right in this city that has all of this right there that you can, you know, partake of, which is really special about Philly and Pittsburgh. So let's pause for just a second on the jazz scene front. Talk a little bit about what you were working on when you were younger as a drummer, when you were practicing, like when you were 17, 18, when you were just getting on the scene and working with some of these older musicians. What were some of the things that you were practicing and what are some of the things that you felt like really were important in your development that you were working on at that time?
Right. Well, you know, as kids do, of course, I was influenced by the people that were important to me that I was listening to musically at the time. And it was when I was 16, 17, a lot of it was Tony Williams and a lot of it was, Steve Gadd. I was like a big fan of Chick Corea and a lot of those groups. A lot of it was, you know, Harvey Mason and Headhunters. It was all these things. So I was naturally attracted to that. And I was a big fan of Weather Report. So I was into all this fusion music. But a lot of those guys were my forefront, and it was, basically for me, I've always had naturally good technique. So, and sometimes I think that might be a detriment to some people's development because it's more important to learn how to express yourself with a little bit as opposed to just going all in right away.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of my experience or a lot of my growth, I was really really working on technical stuff and working on being able to play really fast, you know, and really working on ensemble playing, being able to, like Art Blakey is a master of this, like being able to set up figures for melody. That's mm-hmm. that's really, those things were important to me. And of course, you know, as drummers, like, you know, we're always worried about our time. You know, worry about playing good time, because if you have good time and good taste, that's, you know, you're always almost at the top of the hill with that.
Mm-hmm.
These things were real important. Technically, I was just, I had a good swing feel and I always had good hands or whatever. I could use my feet and that was cool. I think the greatest thing for me was working with people that were older than me, having that opportunity. And then really focusing on me being disciplined, because I wanted to, you know, when you want to do everything that you can, it's about really the more that you try to sound like above your years, and the more that you learn how those older cats really use their fundamentals and their ears to, you know, support the music. That's the best thing. Boosie Barnes is probably the best for me with that. And my brother just kind of constantly trying to keep me involved in the music and paying attention to the younger musicians that were coming up or people that were around, you know, my peers,
yep,
and people above. So for me, it was just I think during that time, my greatest, the greatest thing that helped me learn more was the experience I had dealing with older musicians who were really focused on me being more disciplined and knowing when not to play so much, knowing when to, you know, work on dynamics, that kind of thing. And the sooner you get to do that in your career. If you're a young guy, if you can sound older, the better for you. So it took me, and I teach that to this day. I teach that, and I swear by it. If I feel strange with my playing now, it's always go back to fundamentals. Good time, good taste, dynamics, you know, technical stuff, we can all come up with something about that, you know, but it's really those other intangibles that are important. What you bring to the music from a minimal standpoint, but a strong feeling.
Yeah, I agree. When you say that, you know, you kind of always had good technique, were you working on like rudimental stuff? Did you have a teacher that showed you that at first, or?
Absolutely. Like I have a mentor. His name is Kevin Outerbridge. He's a great drummer, and he's actually a little bit younger than my brother. And we came up together in Philly because they had all these music camps, so I met all these drummers. And at that time, you know, I had a lack of control with single stroke rolls, and you know, I would tense up, and this thing was supposed to be easy. You know, I could always play paradiddles really well and double stroke rolls. But it took me some time to develop a single stroke roll. Those were things I was really interested on in terms of like developing chops to play around the drums was a single stroke roll, finding different patterns to play double stroke roll, paradiddle, flam taps, things like that, flam accents, mm-hmm. you know. And I was so concerned with developing a certain amount of control with the bass drum, being able to do some of the things Tony Williams used to do. And I still can't do them actually, but those were a
You're
lot
not
of my
alone.
it was feel, and it was like me. And here's what I think is important with my playing now. Some of the things, and I always talk about this, trying to find little nuances or little fills or little things that basically set the music up. And in a short amount of time, whether it be a two beat fill or nuance or a four beat, something like that, even if it's a press roll or things, I've always tried to do that, work little things into my playing for breaks or for trading or for just comping. And a lot of that is five stroke rolls, six stroke rolls, you know, so I was really trying to do that. And still to this day, I think when you find phrases that are shorter, that works better for, because everybody can go, you know, it's playing the right thing in the right spot. And sometimes that could be a minimal thing or it could be a big thing. But
yeah.
Focusing on the small little things, roughs and you know, double drag, a lot of the Philly stuff too.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, that's basically where I was coming from technically, you know, but still immature. So people would really stress to me, it's more about the color of your notes and not the notes.
So wow.
You know.
Yeah, man, that's all great information. So as you were getting into the Philadelphia scene as a younger man and playing with older musicians, were you playing in a lot of different types of jazz settings, or was it mostly small group stuff, or were you doing some different things? And if so, what were those?
It was mostly small set. I would say a lot of the things I did was like between trio and sextet, no more than sextet. I didn't really do big band stuff a lot when I was a kid. And even till this day, I've done small, not a whole lot of big band stuff, but it was mainly, I would say more than anything, it was trios and quartets.
Cool.
This is pretty much where I cut my teeth. And that was good. I always preferred that because of the space. I like, you know, I like the space, and I like to be able to contribute or have more of a rapport. You know, I always felt it was for me, it's interesting. I think you have more of a rapport when you have less musicians. I mean, everybody has their role, but it's easy to get more into a dialogue, you know, mm-hmm. and it's just with musicians.
Yeah.
So it was that with smaller groups, and I, you know, I dig that. I actually dig that.
Yeah, absolutely. So during this time, when you're getting out there as a younger person, who were some of the first sort of national or international artist that you worked with, and if you could talk about anything that you learned specifically from those people as a younger musician working with them, because I know from, you know, in my experience, being a younger person and being on stage with someone who's really kind of big is a lot different than playing with guys that you work with a lot, you know, in the city, even when they're great musicians. That's like a different kind of experience. So could you talk a little bit about that?
That's a good point. You bring that up too. And here's the thing, because I was young, it's, you know, it's easy to take that for granted when you have a chance to work with, you know, some people that have been there and done that for so long. But, you know, as you know, and a lot of people know, I worked with Joey DeFrancesco for many years, and we were both young and we kind of grew up together playing. So a lot of the things that kind of branched me out from that was through playing with him when other artists got to hear me. You know, I remember working in Mexico, and I met a guy named George Robert, who was from Switzerland. And one of the first gigs I did outside of, I think I might have been 19, I wasn't quite 20 yet. It was with Tom Harrell. He told me that was one of the things that intrigued me, was Tom Harrell, and it was a great bassist, Reggie Johnson, and a great pianist, Donald Maroney. And I met this guy, and you know, in Mexico, then that branched down to something else. And before I know it, I'm doing a live record with a bunch of saxophonists, like Houston Person, Grover Washington Jr., Illinois Jaquette, who was, you know,
wow.
Illinois. So I had all these guys, Kirk Wilm, I had all these guys, wow. Different genres, different eras, pretty much, you know, all in the same gang. And that just kept branching me out. Before I knew it, I got a call from Betty Carter. And I worked with Betty Carter for a couple of years, and that was, you know, that's a lot to learn there, because you're going to learn more about the delicate side of music, being able to play ballads with more space. And that was a big thing with dynamics, being able to go from a whisper to a roar, any tempo, you know. And that started leading to more people. So it leading to, like, Stanley Turrentine called me. I started working with Bobby Hutcherson. And getting other stuff. I did, like, some stuff with Dave Sanborn, with Lee Rittenhauer. It just kind of branches out. I've worked recently with Cyrus Chestnut. And it's like, it's so easy to forget how many people that you work with. It's really important to document. Because I work with people that it's hard for me to remember them all at the time that it happened.
Sure.
Because life is so funny. But it's important to do that, you know, just having that and being able to go out. I've worked with John Patitucci a year ago. We recorded with Chuck Loeb. That was, you know, just those experiences. And then you get something from each different experience, and regardless of the genre or the type of music that it is, just hanging with different guys, that really makes you who you are, you know.
Yeah.
And being open for that, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's definitely true. Well, why don't we take two of those artists and do kind of a compare and contrast? So why don't you talk for a minute first about working with the great master Bobby Hutcherson, and then talk about how it was different working with Dave Sanborn, because those are two great artists, but they're very, very different. So could you kind of compare and contrast those two experiences?
Absolutely. Like, to compare them, I'm like, Bobby's in the league of...
I know.
both of them are in the league of their own. They both have... And the important thing to think about them is they both have their own voice. They have a very distinctive sound. And that's a lesson within itself, because it's all about your sound. Your sound is what makes you who you are. And then, you know, Bobby has this... this great spiritual vibe about it. I mean, him and I are both believers. We're into faith. And Bob, you know, it really comes through. He's so unusual. He's like, I always say this about all musicians. We're all kind of, I don't know, eccentric, or, you know, we're all so alike and so different. Bobby is like one of the sweetest men I've ever met. I mean, he's like, He'll give you the shirt off his back, and he talks about stories, and it's like things that may have been in the past. He talks about them like it feels like it's present. Mm. And I always felt like I had this, like Bobby was an uncle or a big brother or something like that, because he always had, he liked being around people. And this, you know, this thing, he wanted to comfort you and nurture you. And he said very little about the way you, if he liked the way you played, he'd say, oh man, that's, you know, he said to me, oh man, that's like being in the crack of the whip. He would have these kind of, like, you know, you played something and it made me think about eating pancakes, you know. It's that kind of, but then I think learning, it's an experience, because, you know, it's like you learn most from listening to his approach. Like, I remember playing with him, playing the blues. I think we might have been a blues in that or something like that, or kind of up there, or Take the Coltrane, something like that. And he's playing, and I think that time it was just trio. It was me, him, and Joey DeFrancesco working in at the Artist Guild.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, that was like the first gig I did with him.
Wow.
And he was playing, we were playing the blues, and he played, and I noticed he built the solo up so incredible, and then just walked up before the chorus was done. And after that, I said, man, I said, there's still some left in the chorus. He said, oh, but I was done. You know, when you finish saying what you say, you leave whatever. You don't have, it doesn't have to be so, you know, it doesn't have to be so symmetric. Mm. And, you know, and then with Dave, this is another artist who's basically got this soul thing and this blues thing incredible. His sound is his greatest attribute, you know, and his greatest contribution to the music, his sound and his feeling when he plays. But Dave is so structured. Like, Bobby is so asymmetrical, and Bobby's asymmetrical, and Dave is symmetrical to the point where it's like, okay, you got to make these certain figures within this tune right here because I need to hear this. But at the same time, the energy is going to be over the top, you know. And that's the thing, Bobby's thing, you know, you're gonna start with that simmer and boil. Dave, you're going to come right out from the gate, like, boiling. Mm. That was the difference with those guys, but both of them had what I think they gave to me is a greater awareness still of feeling, the way you approach time, and the energy and what you bring to the music spiritually, how you connect with everybody. Mm. That's really
wow, man. That's it's so great to hear you talk about both of those guys who are so different, but as you said, they're both such individual and singular artists just because of what they bring to the music. So when you're in different situations, this is something I was listening a couple of weeks ago to a younger drummer here in Pittsburgh who was playing a gig, and very talented young guy. And I felt as though he was having a hard time connecting with the music via the other musicians who are in the band, obviously. So my next question to you is, if you're in a situation where you're playing with musicians who you've not worked with before, this could be at a jam session, it could be on a gig, anywhere, what are some of the first things that you're doing in your mind and in your mind's ear to find that connection quickly on stage? What are some of the things you're listening for and doing? I know that might be a little strange, but I don't know how else to word it right now.
That's a good way to put it, because, and I discuss this a lot, because I think it's important for younger musicians to understand the most important thing is to develop some kind of rapport with the musicians you're working with, even if it feels uncomfortable, because everybody has a different perception of time. And harmony sometimes too, it seems like, you know.
Totally.
It's like, it's best to be, this is why we study the music for so many years, because you have to develop a vocabulary to be able to be flexible enough to play wherever the vibe goes to, you know. And it doesn't matter, it could be the simplest thing or the most complex thing. You have to really be able to listen and develop. My thing, I'm going to try to develop some kind of feel with the bass player right away. I got to hook up with the bass player.
Yep.
And then I got to have whoever's comping with me, whether it be piano or guitar, I got to have a dialogue with them. You know, but the time's got to feel good first. I have to create a foundation. And me, you know, Ray Brown said to me, I got a chance to record with Ray Brown once. He said, and that was a big band situation, something I was very uncomfortable with doing.
Wow.
And it was in L.A. It was at Capitol Studios. All these great musicians, Conti Condoli and Shorty Rogers and Jack Mimitz, Ricky Warner, all these great guys. All these Sinatra sessions. And, you know, I was a little bit of a wreck because I was a little bit uncomfortable with that vibe. But I said, okay, I just got to groove. Everything else will take care of itself, you know. And we get in there, we're kind of running over tune, and it felt like the horn section was playing way behind, and me and Ray were way on top of it. We got stopped. I said, man, Ray, was that course? And it felt like they were playing way behind. And he's, you know, he gave me a phrase that I won't say the phrase, but it was like, you know, screw that, you know, we're going to make them play with us. You know, they're going to play. He said, don't worry about it. Screw them. They're going to play with us.
Yeah.
And that was a strong lesson to me. My thing is always try to develop a rapport or some kind of vibe right away with the bass, whoever's really holding down that foundation of time, and let everybody play, make everybody play with you, but not from the sense of being selfish or sacrificing the music, because there's going to be some times where you have to, you know, the thing is never sacrifice the music, but try to make it as comfortable for everybody. And as a drummer, completely, it's not about you at all. You have to, if you can play a good time and you have good taste, everything's going to follow. As long as you have good time and good taste, do that. And then try to slowly develop your way into work, feeling whatever the players, whatever their tendencies are and their, however they go. But best thing is just develop that groove, get a chemistry with the band, and try to let the music dictate to you. Don't try to force your will on it because you used to be on the wrong side.
No, that's, man, I think that last thing you said, all of that was great, but the last thing you said I think is really important, of letting the music tell you what to do. And I think for younger musicians in particular, that can be really difficult because they're, you know, they're anxious and they're nervous, and it takes a certain amount of relaxation to be able to say, okay, what is this saying to me? What does this need from me right now? You know? Yeah.
Exactly. Mentally strong with that, you know, because if you look at it, so much pressure on young musicians, especially in Western music, you know, so much pressure on us. Oh, you got to be great and blah, blah, blah. So you can sometimes develop a sense of pride when you're trying to focus so much on being in the clique that you're not really focusing on playing music honestly from, you know, from the heart, being genuine.
Woo, man. I mean, that... That's something that I see a lot in younger musicians, and I'm not trying to slam younger musicians. I love them, but it's more about helping, right? And it's there. You inevitably see younger players who they could be very talented, but it's more about the social aspect, or more about, like you said, the clique in the social group than like what are we actually here to do. And I find that, you know, as someone who's, you know, I've started to do more teaching in the last, you know, 8 or 10 years, and trying to sort of impart to younger musicians, like, that's all fine. The social aspect is part of it, but this is what we're here to do. You know, this music is our focus. And I find, you know, that can be challenging to sort of, you know, impart. I just do my best to try to just be an example by doing it, but it's challenging. Do you find the same with younger players?
Absolutely. And what you just said, that's all you could do is do your part and kind of, because, you know, this music is really big. It's based on emotional content too. So, you know, you can't teach anybody how to laugh or cry. They can only see what you do or how you do what you do. And they have to understand that they have to find their own path in terms of their feelings and their emotions, the way they apply that musically, you know. But for me, I always deal with my students, and I deal with, anytime I teach or do master classes, it's always talking about being musical, because for so long, so many years, I've spent so much time into trying to, okay, how can I wow people? How can I, you know, and I think a lot of young musicians, you want people to recognize you, and albeit sometimes, most of the time for the wrong reasons. And I'm, trust me, and I love I love all the stuff. I'm just as wild as anybody else when I can see a young guy or anybody play so much stuff, but it's still you'll find out one day you'll end up playing with somebody, if you're fortunate, or somebody older, that you will get exposed for not really focusing on all the things that you thought were important, you know. Things you thought were important are usually not the most important things. Time yeah. and that's hard to teach because it's discipline. It's experience.
Yeah.
You know, experience is going to be your best teacher, you know.
No, absolutely. And also, time and taste, to put it one way, is not very glamorous, you know. I think a lot of younger players, they might know, like, yeah, it is really all about playing great time and grooving and everything, but, and this is where, you know, again, I'm not trying to knock the technology, but a lot of these younger players, they're on, you know, Instagram, and they'll see a 30-second video of someone playing, and they'll look at it and go, wow, that person's amazing, and not realizing, like, well, they might be amazing, but that might have been the 48th take that they did to try to get that 30 seconds to sound a certain way. You're seeing just these very small snippets of things, which is totally different than sitting with someone like the great Butch Ballard or Mickey Roker for several hours, you know?
Indeed. They'll tell you, and a lot, that's what I miss, and this is what I try to fulfill as now somebody, I guess they would consider me an old G, or, you know, older statesman of the music. And I know you and I, we both look different than when we first met.
Yes, sir, we do.
Getting there.
Yep.
But, you know, it's important to, you know, and I think about that. I really stress that on you. It's so important to really try to work on being patient with the music and developing a good sound, and listen to these recordings and think about why did our mentors and I, why did they play what they played? You know, that's the important. You got to get into the music, you know, psychologically too, and from, you know, an emotional standpoint, and not just think about what's going to make you sound good or what's the slickest thing to play with this. It's more about feeling that you can provide, and is it a thing that's where it's compatible to whatever the situation, you know, what's coming from each musician.
Yeah.
We have to be able to adapt and say things and be in the way and be out of the way at the same time, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah, it is. It is hard. And I think that's where, as you said earlier, the patience and the time factor, you know, you do have to put that time in. It's not, you're not just a click away from it, you know. It's something that demands that you spend the time in learning how to do it. So, man, yeah, that's some really important stuff. There's other stuff we could talk about, but we'll do that next time. I wanted to move on to an area of drumming and an area of jazz drumming that you're really great at, and that's with, of course, playing with organ players. And I wanted to get some of your thoughts about the differences between playing with a bassist and an organist, and some of the things that you as a drummer are doing differently between those two situations musically.
Well, that's a good question too. But I've gotten that a lot over some years now, because I was been blessed to play with a lot of those organists, a lot of the great organists of our time. I've always, you know, the strange thing about me is I never really approached playing with an organist any different as playing with a bassist. Now, the thing where I'll say that you should focus on when working with organists is the point of the beat from them playing bass, because when you're playing with an organist, you have to understand that they don't have, like, when you're playing with a bassist and an organist, the difference is the bassist, somebody pulling the strings is going to have a percussive effect. Somebody playing a keyboard that has the sound going through something, a Leslie that has a spinning and dispersing the sound in different areas and different things, you have to really be focused on your quarter note feel. And your feel has to be strong enough so that the organist will, you kind of compel the organist to play with you, with your beat.
Wow.
Because they're doing so much, the organ is like an orchestra. So they have all these different sounds and draw bars and things that they're doing. So sometimes time can be really wide. you have to make sure that you develop, you know how to have a really wide time field, but at the same time, you have a really good quarter note that's distinctive that they can always sit on, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's, that was really important. When I was really young, I worked with, a really famous organist. I didn't even know who he was at the time, because I was like 14. His name was Herbie Nicks. And I can't tell you who he recorded with. I think he might have recorded with Sonny Stitt. But, you know, it was just incredible. And I was young, I didn't know any better. But I just had a natural feeling with him because we kind of hooked up on the same thing. When you're close to the organ player, that has an effect on the sound. You can hear things better. You can feel. But I played in giant halls where the organ player is 30 feet away. And if there's no direct, the sound can be very, you know, it can be something that you can't trust because you just, you know, and then you may not be trusting your own beat at that. It's so important to just sit back and develop a really good pulse. And when I say that, I mean the quarter note pulse. And you don't have to play quarter note, ding, 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 but it should be everything you play, however you mix your ride cymbal thing up or your time feel. That pulse is very important because the organ player, if they're really good and they're listening, they will be able to always lean on you. So I've been fortunate. But I always say time is time. We all have to keep our own time, but we have to be cognizant of what's going on around us. So your ears are the most important for you. And I've learned from that from playing with, you know, with Joey DeFrancesco for 20 plus years and having the chance to work with Jimmy Smith and record with him, Jimmy McGriff, Jack McDuff, Dr. Lonnie Smith, Gene Ludwig, Charles Erlin. I played with just about all of them. And it was like they all like to hear something different. But I noticed the common thing is your groove, and you have to give it to them. You can't sit back and be, unless they suggest it, you still have to give them the business. So be at your best. Have your ears open. Have a good beat. And when they give you the space, you go ahead and you give it, you deliver.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Like I did a lot of organ gigs too earlier in my career, and it is sort of similar to playing with a big band, which some people, you know, liken it to. And you know, I remember doing, and I know I'm sure you did a bunch of these in your career, but you know, different Hammond organ festivals where you'll be playing with two or three organists at the same time and dealing with how each of them play, as you said, slightly different, and you got to adjust on the fly. That's, man, you know.
That's why it's important for us. Like, and this is another thing I say, and I'll say this for young musicians too. And regardless of what instrument you play, it's so important to learn what came before you. Because when somebody hears you play, when I think of you, I said Tom Wimp. I want to hear the history that led before Tom Wimp. I want to hear everything that leads up to Tom Wimp, and I want to hear Tom Wimp too. So, and you're playing, I want to hear the history that led up to you, and what you're bringing to the music. You know, your contribution, and that's really important because if you do that, you have to know where you've been to know where you're going.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Yeah. It's important, man. So in terms of playing, with organ players as a drummer, when you're soloing in that context, it's not really much different than playing with another group. Would you agree with that? Or do you find that improvising in that setting is different?
It's been the same. And of course, that always depends on the music and like your soloing. It depends on whether it's like, whether it be an ostinato type solo.
Right.
Or bebop solo or something like over a particular form.
Yep.
I mean, those things come down to you. I think with that being said, you, like us as drummers, and you have to be able to play a lot of different types of improvisation. What I mean by that is, you have to be able to play a solo like Philly, or be able to play, you know, a BA type form solo where you can, you know, play. You have to be able to play an ostinato where you have a little bit more freedom to play with what they're doing, but you have to develop a concept or an idea. And it's also important to be able to play free by yourself when you're working on sounds and colors and dynamics, different things like that. If you have a good concept, if you have a good understanding of those three different ways to approach soloing, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
And the thing is still, even with your with soloing and the word, so to speak, you have to be able to roll wherever the music goes when you come back, and if things are not quite where they should be, you have to be able to state it. And I think that all great musicians can do this, regardless of instrument, whatever. If things are kind of chaos or chaotic or out of the way or out of semblance or whatever, boom, this is one bang. And I don't mean being obnoxious about it, but I mean playing it in a way where it compels everybody to just jump right on it. It kind of pulls everything together.
Yeah.
I think you have to have the ability with that. And me working with so many different organs, you got to be able to adjust on the fly with your time feel and with your soloing concepts and be able to listen and let the music direct you to what path you should take. And that's easier said than done.
Yeah, no, totally. Sticking with playing with organ players for a minute, I know for me, I learned to sort of simplify when things would get a little wonky time-wise, you know, just as you said, focusing on the pulse, but also sort of trying to meet whoever that organ player is halfway, but still keeping the groove happening, obviously, you know?
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It all comes down to communication, you know, because I don't care who it is, everybody has their funny days or their not so on point days.
Sure.
And the whole thing is how you kind of react to things when they don't go the way you plan on it.
Yeah.
And you have to do that in a subtle way because you're an artist, and a lot of times people won't recognize that unless you completely panic. You know, so it's still about it's still about basically trying to find some common ground with the people you're working with. It's that eye contact, it's that ear contact, it's saying, okay, I'm going to make the one, and we're not all where one is should be, or whatever, and doing it in a way where everybody can just lean on instead of, you know, saying, oh, this is it, you know. It's all about being able to communicate with people on whatever level it is. And if I may go to add to that, you know, Betty Carter told me, she says, oh, forget all about trying to play stuff to appease musicians, and you're dealing with an audience, you're dealing with people, they don't really know what you're doing technically or whatever. It's about how do you communicate to people? How do you draw them into something? They may be listening to you for a first time, listening to the that type of music for the first time. You have to find a way to communicate with them, or it could be on a simplistic way or be complex, but you still have to communicate with them, but yourselves as a band first. You with the band first, then with the audience. So important.
Mm, yeah, it seems like jazz musicians can be so guilty of thinking that all they have to do is walk out on stage and play an amazing solo, and that's all they got to do to be great. And, you know, that's kind of part of it, but what you just said tells me that there's so much more to it. The idea of, as a group, being able to communicate with the people you are playing for, and doing that, sort of meeting that group of people wherever they are. You know, if you're playing for a super hip audience that knows the music, that's easy. You can have fun with that. But if you're playing for an audience that might have never heard it before, you know, you have to meet them where they are. Not just meet the other musicians where they are, but you got to meet the audience where they are. Would you agree?
That's absolutely right. Because you got to look at it. Music is a language, you know. It's like, and we build our vocabulary. It's like us learning. Say you learn another language, you build up all this vocabulary. And basically, when you communicate with somebody, you want to communicate with them on their level. If I know every word in the dictionary, when I have a conversation with Tom Wendt, I'm not going to say every word in the dictionary. I'm just going to say whatever I can say so we can understand.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not going to say too much because you're not going to listen to me. If I talk too loud, you're not going to listen to me. I got to communicate with you.
Yeah, man, there's so much that goes into doing this. Sometimes it's like I laugh because it's just like being a great player of your instrument is literally just one part of it. It's where most people think it's everything. It's literally like one part, you know. So we've got a few minutes left. I wanted to sort of wrap up and talk about some of the things that you're working on today as a player. What are some of the things that you're sort of trying? What areas are you trying to grow in? And if you could talk to us a little bit about like what you do when you're practicing.
Well, what I do when I practice, I like to spend a little bit of time of just loosening up, just to warm up, whatever. And that might be whatever, some things like combinations of rebounds with both hands simultaneously and single as well. And just to, you know, working on rolls, the real simple thing, working on being able to control the double stroke roll, play it open as well as closed, being able to play it slowly and in fast tempos. I work on playing time, you know, and regardless, time and feels, you know, meaning whether it be a Latin kind of vibe, a straight ahead vibe, or whatever kind of, you know, whatever you play, a funk vibe, a rock vibe, anything. Mm-hmm. Playing that, all different kinds of tempos. I work on getting sounds out of the drums, working on colors, playing parts of the drums that I don't play, that I normally don't use. I may play mallets on the drums, just trying to get different sounds and seeing what I got. I try to focus on me manifesting a sound in my mind and trying to convey that through the drums, which is that's kind of deep. It's psychological, I guess, or
sure,
you know. But and I think about wet sounds, dry sounds, you know, color sounds. I think about playing rims and playing using the whole set. I'll think about that, and I also like to spend some time on something you know you can't do, or something that's difficult for you. I might work on playing something where I gotta play 9 for a while, then play 11, and then play 7, and play 5. Just something I know I have a hard time with, and I'll do that. But definitely, it's important that you spend a little bit of time just warming up. Spend some time playing time from the slowest to the fastest. All different kinds of grooves, whether it be swing, funk, rock, Latin, play all of them. Work on playing colors, no time. Get mallets, get brushwork, work on just getting sounds out of the drums. And work on playing something you know you can't play. And I listen to all kinds of music for inspiration and experiences. I listen to, you know, tabla. I like Alaraca, and I listen to that from a rhythmic point of view and how they break down rhythm. I like classical music. I like jazz. I like is only good and bad music. That's and right. I try to get something from every type of genre, and every place that I go, I try to absorb something from their culture, whether it be the simplest thing or whatever, whatever important or what people think may not be so important.
Yeah.
But those things influence me, and I'm always open to what younger musicians are playing and the way that they compose, because I think that's important. I'm trying to work more on my reading. My reading is probably one of my weakest points. Mm-hmm. I would say being able to interpret somebody's writing, you know, because there's so many ways that you can look at that, and if they had just hand you a piece, sometimes it could be a little bit overwhelming. You know, some people are really good at catching it right away, and some people that might you take some time, like, okay, let's play this a while, but, you know, once you get it, you got it. So I'm trying to work on recognizing those things ahead of time in terms of reading music and interpreting people's original music.
Yeah.
And I'm still just trying to work on fundamentals and those four things I just told you. Work on playing a groove, all grooves, different times. Work on warming up your hands, work on, you know, your rolls and stuff like that. Work on playing something you cannot play. And find new sounds. Work on finding anything that you could find on the drum set that you can apply musically to any genre of music.
Yeah, man, that's all great advice. I know when it comes to reading, it's, you know, it's the kind of skill, like a lot of skills, if you don't use it, you can lose it. So, you know, working on it on your own can be really a beneficial thing, man. I know for me, I'm always striving to get to the point where I can read something but not sound like I'm reading something, which is hard.
That's the thing, too. You know, it's one thing if you can interpret, if you can absorb some of it, and you know how to anticipate how it's written and how the chart goes, you can play with more of a sense of freedom, as opposed to like looking at something and being boxed into it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, if it's difficult, or if you have some kind of anxiety, or you got to sight read it, you know, at the Carnegie Hall or whatever the case may be, you know.
Yeah. I hear you, man. So just to wrap up, man, what do you have coming up, man? Music wise, man, what's getting ready to happen?
I'm actually going to be around for a while.
Oh, cool.
Surprisingly, you know, I had been really busy in between July and last month. I went to Spain. I was in Spain with a great guitarist named Chimo Tabar. I was up there with him and Pat Bianchi. And we to Spain, and then I came back and I was pretty busy at home. And then I went out with Cyrus Chestnut to Bogota, Colombia. Him and Cyrus Chestnut and Mark Whitfield and Herman Burney we did like a week and a half there.
Nice.
I was just in Italy in late October through November, working with a great friend of mine, Massimo Ferraro, who's a pianist. And Nicole and I did like maybe this was like a lot of recording for a label at Zora Records, but it was like a lot of I don't want to call it jingles, but it seems like the direction of recording, that's a lot of like live stream kind of things that are on the online. So man, I must have recorded like 150 tunes.
Wow.
I work with this, but I've done that, and I came back November. When did I get back? I have to look at it to remember. Yeah, I came back on the 6th, and then I did a recording with a guitarist named Jorge Caraglino from Spain. And I did that in Paramus, New Jersey, Trading Eights. And I had my own band in Philly with a great bassist from Pittsburgh, my little brother, Sam Harris.
Oh, I know Sam very well.
And I did the festival the day after that in Cape May that my friend Oren Evans had been curating for. He's on the board there, so he's been trying to curate them and help them with the talent that they bring in the groups. So I was there with a great young vibraphonist from there named Ben Galise.
Oh, yeah.
And Brian Betts and me and Pat Bianchi. And I was, I did a couple gigs with Joe Magnarelli. And Akiko Saruga, I've been working with a lot. She's a great young organist from, and who's been getting a lot of credibility and a lot of attention paid to her, rightfully so. She's great. I recorded a record with her almost a year ago. It should be coming out. But I have some future work coming up with her. We're going to be in Switzerland in February, and we're also going to be in, I think we're going to be at the Florida State University or Florida State or the University of Florida.
Beautiful, man.
I've been working with a singer with Ruth Naomi Floyd, and I work with some young guys, in Philly recently, a great young tenor player, and piano combos like Joe Block is the pianist and Dylan Band is a tenor saxophonist with a great young singer who's in New York now. His name is Tyreek McDowell. I think he won the Sarah Vaughan thing. He's Sarah Vaughan competition. And I think he's like the first male or second male to win that.
But this wow.
is kids. Honey Hartman and Joe Williams and everybody wrapped up in one. And he had his own thing, too. He plays trumpet and writes music. So it's like,
wow.
I've been blessed to get these gigs with all these different people.
That's wonderful, Ben.
Coming up, Alex Claffey and Benny Benack, the third.
I got stuff.
Yeah, I know you know him.
So, oh, yeah, absolutely.
So it would be nice to just try to get caught up on what's happening here and try to work on some stuff. just playing a little bit and keeping myself on top and trying to work on recording some music or better yet, writing some music, coming up with some concepts.
Man, so. Beautiful. Man, that's great. It makes my day to know that those younger guys are calling you, man. That's really great. That's how it should be.
Exactly, man. And you know, they appreciate. I don't take them for granted. They don't. And I'm fortunate that a lot of them that I know, they don't take me for granted either.
Oh yeah.
Even when I go to New York, there's guys that know me, young guys that know me. I wouldn't expect to know me, and I'm like, oh, okay. I have to say to everybody, even if I don't remember them, I say, oh yeah, I remember. Yeah.
I hear you, man. I hear you, man. Well, you know, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to talk, man. It's such a pleasure, man. I've loved your playing for so many years, and it's been such an honor to get to know you, man. And I hope we can collaborate in some different ways in the future, man. So
always my pleasure, Tom. And man, I love your playing as well. You're special. You're special to your community, and you're special to this drummer and this whole music scene.
Yeah,
and I love what you do with the podcast. Man, anytime, brother. Anytime, anything I could do, let me know.
And that is it for episode 11. Thank you for listening. Please like, share, subscribe, give us a 5-star rating, write some words into the review space on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate you. Also, a reminder, we have Drum Candy t-shirts for sale on Drum Factory Direct. Also, there is the Carter McLean Masterclass coming up here at the end of April. That's April 28th. You can get tickets at Eventbrite. Just search Carter McLean Masterclass. That is in partnership between Drum Factory Direct, Drum Candy Podcast, the Pennsylvania Chapter of Percussive Arts Society, and hosted over at Hawthorne Drum Shop. That's April 28th with Carter McLean. Go get your tickets at Eventbrite. Till next time, have a good one. See you then.